Hello, Hub listeners. I'm Sean Spear, the Hub's editor at large. Usually I'm joined for the weekly Friday roundtable by the Hub's executive director, Rudyard Griffiths, but he's off this week on a well-deserved vacation. And instead, I'm here with the Hub's managing editor, Harrison Lohman. Harrison, thanks so much for joining me for another episode of the Hub Roundtable.
Thanks, Sean.
Before we get into today's conversation, I want to recognize a number of people who responded to our calls for support and joined us this week as Hub Fellows: Charles L., Grant M., Herb G., Michael H., Neil P., Sean D., and Sean M. Thank you so much for joining us as Hub Fellows. And for those listeners who are inclined, we thank you in advance for your ears, your eyes, and your financial support. Harrison, let's get into today's conversation. We'll cover two big issues as we always do. First half of the show, we'll talk about Monday's controversial motion brought forward by the NDP and ultimately supported by the Liberal government concerning the Israel-Hamas war. And in the back half of the show, we'll mark the two-year anniversary of the Liberal-NDP supply agreement. Yes, indeed, it's 2 years today, March 22nd. We'll talk about the policy implications of that agreement and what it's meant for both parties. But before we get there, Harrison, we have to talk about Monday's motion. It really did shape the week to it all. Why don't you just give listeners a bit of a refresher about the motion itself, the chaotic amendment process that ultimately led to Monday's vote, and what precisely it means for Canadian policy vis-a-vis Israel and its war against Hamas?
Sure. So this was a motion brought forward by the NDP, non-binding, of course, meaning that the government isn't obligated to, you know, move forward with the actions. But it came with a raft of recommendations, and it was pitched by the NDP as this big thing, which they had brought. You know, they'd been on break last few days through their ridings. They pitched this as sort of their response to the Israel-Hamas conflict. And it was seen as being sort of quite impactful. So they bring this forward. It says things like, you know, call for a ceasefire, release of the hostages. We're going to need to end military trade with Israel, bring back the UNRWA funding, which we've already brought back, ban extremist settlers from Canada, put sanctions on Israeli officials inciting genocide. So a lot of stuff there. So what happens once it gets to Parliament? We have a day of back and forth.
Hold on, Harrison. And most controversially, don't forget.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I cannot forget that it officially called for Canada to recognize the state of Palestine. And if we'd gone through with this, you know, if the government followed up on this, if the motion had been in its original form, the government had followed up, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, Canada would become the first country in the G7 to formally recognize the state of Palestine. Other countries have signaled towards this. I think France and the U.S. are making moves, but no one's formally come out and said it. Now, you look at the U.N., there's 193 members. Almost 140 have recognized Palestine, including almost every country in South and Central America, Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe.
The countries that consistently condemn Israel before the U.N. and ignore human rights atrocities elsewhere around the world. So not necessarily the best company to be in, but point taken.
So this makes its way to Parliament. And there's a debate for a whole day on this motion. And then in the final hour, 20 minutes before the vote is held, and, you know, us, you know, folks at the Hub were anxiously awaiting this, wondering what was going on because there was so much back and forth. There are 14 amendments made, and the thing sort of becomes a Frankenstein, and it sort of becomes, you know, watered down to a point where the Liberals, you know, the majority of Liberals felt comfortable supporting it. Obviously, there was an attempt here by the NDP to wedge the Liberals. So they end up supporting it because they want to be everything to everyone at this point. I kind of described it to you guys earlier this week. It's almost like they're stuck in a Bermuda Triangle with their compass spinning in all directions, right? They're not sure where they're at. They're not sure where they want to go. And, you know, they want to be everything to everyone anyway. So yeah, basically we end up with the amendment that we have today. So they removed officially recognizing the state of Palestine. They removed sanctioning Israeli officials who incite genocide. All references to occupation were actually removed as well. And at the end of the day, Sean, I remind our listeners and our viewers that the motion is non-binding. So one wonders, you know, how much this actually means. Symbolic, yes, but, you know, at the end of the day, what does this mean?
Yeah, well, we could come to how it may influence government policy in a minute, because we are already seeing calls on the government to suspend the provision of weapons to Israel as it continues to carry out its war against Hamas. But I want to take a minute to just unpack your observations about the inherent political dynamic here between the New Democrats and the Liberals, and perhaps more importantly, within the Liberal Party itself, because as you say, Harrison, that seems to be where most of the action is on this issue. These issues, of course, have galvanized all Canadians, but particularly the progressive left. We've seen that play out not just in Parliament, but frankly, across the country over the past several months. And it looked like for a moment there, Harrison, the New Democrats had conceived of a plan that would really, as you say, shock the Liberal caucus. That is to say, these issues have divided the Liberal caucus more so than the NDP and the Conservatives. And the original version of the motion, we have reason to believe, would have secured the support of some considerable number of Liberal MPs, in fact. And so the cabinet met over the weekend. We it's been reported, and continued to meet throughout the day on Monday while members of Parliament were in the chamber delivering passionate speeches for and against the motion. And in the end, those deliberations within the cabinet and then in negotiation with the New Democrats ultimately got to the place of amended motion that enabled virtually every Liberal MP to endorse it. I think there were ultimately three who didn't. And so there are some people saying that this is a case of the New Democrats kind of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. I have to ask you, what do you think explains the decision on the part of Jagmeet Singh and the NDP to ultimately concede to the Liberal amendments and not effectively force the government to vote on the original version, which as I said, we have reason to believe would have exposed or displayed in front of Canadians the extent to which these issues are dividing the Liberal Party.
Mm-hmm. So I think the ultimate question is here: what could the NDP possibly have asked for in exchange for watering down a non-binding motion?
Good question.
And we know, and we'll talk about this with the confidence supply agreement, they meet regularly. The leaders meet regularly. You can imagine they're quite close at this point with various MPs meeting one another. I add to this the fact that the far left, a lot of them have checked out when it comes to Mr. Jagmeet Singh. For example, I'm reading, there's a left-wing publication called The Maple that, even in October was saying, we will no longer feature any NDPers or any NDP staff on our website over this issue in terms of their response to the Israel-Hamas conflict. So that sort of gives you a taste of, how much pressure the NDP is facing when it comes to, speaking to the quote-unquote Palestinian, side of this. A lot of Muslim voters in Canada, there's a lot of pressure being applied from Muslim associations, which were, pushing for this motion. I just wanted to add to that when Jagmeet Singh tweeted out how pleased he was about the motion passing, albeit watered down, the way he phrased it, it sounded as if, he said, we got the government to do X, we got them to do Y, we got them to do Z. When in actuality, as we mentioned, it's non-binding. So it's sort of, you can treat it as sort of a recommendation, or this is, something we feel needs to be highlighted. And Twitter actually, the community note, fact-checked him and said, reminded Canadians that, this is not how Parliament works. This is but a non-binding motion. It is not government policy.
I take your point. Let me kind of take up two observations in response. First of all, I think you're right to speculate on what else we may ultimately see come out of this in terms of a concession from the government in response to the NDP ultimately agreeing to amend the motion. It kind of reminds me of like those old Cold War negotiations where you know, months later, you'd see the Americans or the Soviets do something that in and of itself didn't make sense. But if you understood it as part of a broader negotiation, something that might have taken place months earlier, it might. So, you know, we have a budget coming up next month. Maybe we'll see further progress on NDP priorities because the NDP was ultimately prepared to you know, effectively give the Liberal Party an out on what would have otherwise been a pretty excruciating vote for the parliamentary caucus, which I guess is really my second point. You focused on the pressure that the New Democrats are facing on these issues, which is fair enough. You know, but the extent to which the country may or may not be divided, you know, it seems to me as a kind of institutional metaphor, the Liberal Party has just been shot through with polarization on this issue. You know, there's obviously members of parliament like Anthony Housefather who've effectively said that the party has effectively reconceptualized its position on Middle Eastern issues in the past several years, tilting more in the direction of Palestine and away from the party's historic position of support for Israel. And then, of course, there are Muslim members of the Liberal Caucus, some of whom signed an open letter several weeks ago, effectively calling for a lot of the measures that we've seen ultimately in this motion. I guess just before I turn it back to you, I do want to take up both the extent to which it may or may not be binding, and just more broadly how we ought to and how we've come to think about the motion itself. I'm not so convinced, Harrison, about the non-binding part. I mean, I understand legally it is, but practically you have members of the cabinet, including Melanie Joly, the foreign affairs minister, essentially voting for the provisions of the motion. It seems to me there are some ethical or moral obligation for the vote to mean something. And as I say, we've already seen those demands manifested in the government reportedly halting the provision of weapons to Israel as it fights, against an enemy that slaughtered 1,200 of its citizens, 5 months ago, and continues to hold more than 100 hostages, including 1-year-olds and 80-year-olds. And so in that sense, Harrison, I have to say, I was trying to think of an analogy to what we saw play out this week. And let me put this to you and see if it resonates. It's kind of the equivalent, it seems to me, of like Mexican cartels, but not just Mexican cartels, ones that are kind of inextricably tied either to provincial or possibly even the state government in Mexico, crossing the Texas border, slaughtering in the most brutal way 1,200 American citizens, bringing back over the Mexican border more than 100 American citizens without really understanding or knowing their fate. And the Americans, of course, responding, as one would expect, with its military might. And within 5 months of that campaign, the Canadian Parliament effectively condemning the American operation and abandoning support for an ally. That's how I feel like this motion plays out. Whatever one thinks about the particular provisions or the amended provisions, this strikes me as Canada abandoning an ally in a time of need. And I have to say, I think it was a shameful parliamentary moment. I can't really think of another way to put it. How would you respond to that?
I'd have to add as well, just to say that at the same time, you can add to that analogy the fact that there are also tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza, also, you know, you could say being held hostage by this quasi-government terrorist group, right? And that, you know, are also victims of the ensuing conflict here. The government's being pulled in all directions. You can just imagine them, you know, getting tugged this way and that, which is why they, you know, at the end of the day, they, you know, like they say, you know, you have to add to the amendment that Hamas must lay down his arms. Oh, also, Hamas is listed as a terrorist organization in Canada, but at the same time, we have to ensure that we're not funding, their arms. So they're being pulled every which way. I think internationally, you're seeing, like, I wonder if Israel becomes a voting issue in the next election. I wonder if you see Jews internationally. And I say this as someone who's, part Jewish. My family on my dad's side escaped Nazi Germany and actually went to Israel, found refuge there in the 30s. I wonder if you're going to find Jews who feel like the reaction, they're being blamed as a people as opposed to the Israeli government being blamed as a government for what's going on there. You wonder if they start to gravitate towards conservative parties who are, more willing to, raise the Israeli flag. I think one of the major questions here, and, we've been asking ourselves this since the founding of Canada, is, what role does Canada actually have to play in a foreign conflict? What can actually be done when we have all these protests and demonstrations out on the street on either side? What influence do we actually have when it goes to what is going on the ground over there? Like, what do you think, Sean?
Well, I would just say, in a way, implicit in your question, it seems to me, is there's not much we can do, which only reinforces that in the absence of a kind of genuine, tangible contribution, the least we can do is stand on principle. And, I come back to the point that a major ally was attacked in the most brutal way on October 7th and naturally has responded with a military campaign that has different objectives, everything ranging from recovering its hostages to restoring the principle of deterrence, which is existential for the state of Israel, to ultimately crippling Hamas' capacity as a terrorist organization. I happen to believe in all of those objectives. Now, can one dispute or debate how the campaign has been carried out? Sure, I'm not a military expert, and I'll leave that to others. But it's just shocking to me, Harrison, that against that backdrop, a majority of parliamentarians voted for a motion that even the amended version essentially calls on the Canadian government to effectively abandon a major ally in its time of need. And I think you're right. I do think that this will be a voting issue for a lot of Canadians. I feared, given what I just set out, to discover what that actually means, because the Liberal Party here is not isn't acting irrationally. I think it's acting in some ways in an unprincipled manner, but I don't think it's acting irrationally. It's clearly made the judgment that when you account for how these issues are playing out in progressive circles, that it was unsustainable for it to continue to strongly support the state of Israel. And so I think it will manifest itself in the next election. But one hopes, and maybe this sounds a bit naive, but one hopes that when it comes to these fundamental issues, that electoral considerations aren't at the top of mind of our parliamentarians. And I guess if I was steel manning, before I turn it back to you, if I was steel manning the other side on these issues, I think they'd probably push back on that. They would say that they are acting, at least the New Democrats are acting in the name of their own moral judgments about what's played out over the past several months. I don't know what to make of what's motivating the Liberals besides, as you said at the very outset, a kind of weather vane politics.
So yeah, in terms of looking at them from their perspective, because as a journalist, I'm always trying to put myself in the shoes of, what they're thinking. I think, you talked about all the military objectives that, again, the state of Israel has, the government, the military of Israel. And I guess from some of their perspective would say, to what end? Like, are they achieving this objectives and at what cost when it comes to human life? And an inability on their side often to basically, you need to direct your anger, frustration, and desperation towards that state military and government, not the people, residents within Canada who happen to be Jewish. These are sort of separate things.
Yeah, well said. I think this will be a subject we come back to, because this motion doesn't just end this week. We'll no doubt the Democrats will use it in the coming weeks and months as a cudgel to insist that the government take up precisely some of the things that it voted in favor of. And so we'll stay tuned. But let's take a break, Harrison. And when we come back, we'll talk about the second anniversary of the supply agreement between the NDP and the Liberals, because, of course, Monday's vote isn't the only instance when the two have come together to pass important votes and pieces of legislation over the past couple of years. Stay tuned. We'll talk a bit about the policy and political consequences of that agreement.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. In 2024, thanks to new federal legislation, the majority of most journalist salaries in Canada will be funded by a combination of supports from Google Canada and the Government of Canada. Yes, you heard me right. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be taking these government supports. But producing high-quality news and analysis that is independent is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join now at thehub.ca.
I'm Sean Spear, the Hub's editor-at-large, back for the second half of the weekly Friday roundtable with the Hub's managing editor, Harrison Lohman. In the first half of the show, we talked about Monday's parliamentary motion concerning Israel-Hamas. In the second half, as I said earlier, we're going to take up the second anniversary of the Liberal NDP supply agreement. It was announced on March 22nd, 2022. One can find the details of that agreement on Justin Trudeau's website. And we want to talk here, Harrison, about how the agreement has played out over the past couple of years, who's won, who's lost, and really just try to make sense of the policy and politics of it. Before we get into that kind of analysis, why don't you, again, just give our listeners a bit of a refresher? What led to the agreement? What's sort of the basic contours of the agreement? And what are some of the deliverables that we've seen thus far?
Sure. So this all kicked off in the spring of 2022, right? And you can imagine, just ideologically looking at the political spectrum, I think it's fair to say objectively that the Liberal Party has shifted to the left, right? Nudging up against the NDP. So they're more, you know, they have more things in common. They share more values than they did, say, I don't know, 15 or so years ago. Okay. So they come together and, you know, the Liberal Party, the Trudeau government wants to stay in power. They want to make sure that they survive confidence votes. So they come together and they put this document together. And I think it's only the second time ever, the other one was in 1972, federally, that there was this formal inter-party agreement that sort of listed guiding principles in terms of, you know, what the Liberals would provide to the NDP in return for them, quote unquote, propping up the government. All right. And it was pitched as sort of a moral document. If you actually look at it, I hope you did your homework, Sean, and read it last night like I did. You know, they say things like politics doesn't have to be adversarial, which I loved. This is a guiding principle of no surprises. So if you move forward 2 years, what has it got? What has it got them? Okay. It got dental care for seniors. You know, that's shifting into uninsured low and middle income Canadians. Pharmacare, they pitched. Initially, they've got sort of diabetes meds and contraceptives. They've checked that box, and that's going to shift into a much larger program. 10 days paid sick leave for federal workers. They've started some replacement worker legislation, tweaks on child care, reconciliation, housing, jobs, taxation. All those things have yet to be, you know, accomplished in big ways, along with seniors legislation, expanding ability to vote, child care, a home buyer's bill of rights. So it's quite extensive. It's quite historic, and it just celebrated its 2-year-old birthday today.
Well, it's a great outline. One of the things that struck me, though, going back and rereading it last night, was actually how narrow the commitment on the part of the NDP was to support the government. The agreement says, and I quote, "The NDP agrees to support the government on confidence and budgetary matters, notably on budgetary policy, budget implementation bills, estimate, and supply, and that the Liberal Party commits to govern for the duration of the agreement. The NDP
until
would,
2025, right?
Precisely. Yes. The NDP would not, it goes on to say, move a vote of non-confidence nor vote for a non-confidence motion during the term of the arrangement, unquote. So in that sense, Harrison, the Democrats preserve for themselves quite a lot of scope for independence vis-a-vis the government on non-confidence measures. And the truth is, most of what Parliament tends to vote on, either in the full House or at committee, fall into the non-confidence category. And yet what's been fascinating over the past couple of years is that notwithstanding the narrow commitment on the part of the Democrats, the party has consistently supported the government on non-confidence measures, even ones that on the face of it, appear to be against the interests of the NDP as a political party, as a party that ostensibly wants to grow its popularity and increase its seat count and, you know, in theory, form the government in Canada. And yet, you know, I think, for instance, Harrison, of the NDP partnering with the Liberals to stop parliamentary hearings into different cases of government scandal, including the Winnipeg Labs, including the ArriveCan issue, including the Wii scandal in the context of the pandemic. It's completely puzzling to me, Harrison, why the NDP has essentially gone beyond the agreement, think kind of agreement plus, in terms of its almost Stockholm syndrome-like support for the government. What do you make of that?
Stockholm syndrome.
What explains it?
Well, here's some hard numbers. You like numbers, Sean. Okay, does the NDP have enough money for an election? This is how much they raised last year. 6.8 million. Liberals, 15.6 million. Conservatives, more than double, 35 million. So I think that should tell you something. In terms of what they're blocking, yeah, it's gone. It's sort of grown tentacles and gone beyond, I think, in some ways, you know, the original tension of the agreement. You know, a few weeks ago, in the agreement, it says, we'll communicate about, you know, causing unnecessary obstructions. And to what you just mentioned, is an unnecessary obstruction blocking a parliamentary investigation into the Winnipeg lab security breach so the Canadians don't learn more information about that? Like, is that the intent? Is that envisioned 2 years ago when it comes to forming this agreement meant to address, you know, the adversarial nature of politics? There's a quote. I was trying to find it while you were talking to me, but I'm not fast enough. There's a quote from a journalist in The Guardian about, you know, what is a political party? You know, some would say on the left when it comes to the NDP that in many ways it's about shifting that Overton window, that you can have power by not being in power. Others would say you've lost your mind when you have a political party, you know, its sole purpose is to achieve power and implement policy. You can't be this sort of barnacle on the side of the government ship. So I don't know. I guess it's up to opinion. Like, it'd be interesting to poll NDPers at this point and say, you know, do you feel like the NDP have used power over the last 2 years? Are you satisfied with that? Certainly the leader of the NDP seems satisfied with what's been going on over the last little while. And the Liberals say, Liberal Health Minister Mark Holland said, absolutely, we continue, you know, the agreement continues to serve the government. You know, if we lost it, he said it'd be like pulling the fire alarm. Weirdly, Singh says at the same time last year, you know, one of my NDP MPs has described working with the Liberals like wrestling eels that are soaked in oil, which is a very weird quote. So it's like, you know, I guess he's willing to wrestle the eels for the foreseeable future.
Indeed. Your observation, Harrison, about the NDP's mission being less about winning elections and more about shifting the Overton window is well taken. I think there is something to that. And it you know, one could argue that Justin Trudeau is Canada's greatest NDP prime minister in the country's history. So, you know, that may be what enables New Democrats to sleep well at night. But as I come back to my earlier point, it seems to me you could have achieved a lot of that without without sort of compromising on principle when it comes to issues like parliamentary accountability. Be remiss, though, let's just take up in the final minutes of the conversation what you think this means for the Conservatives. You know, listeners who follow parliamentary proceedings will have grown accustomed to hearing Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre talk about the Liberal NDP government at different times. He accuses the Democrats of being handmaidens of the Liberals, and other times he does the opposite. How, if at all, do you think that the supply agreement has influenced or shaped Conservative politics? Is it a factor, for instance, in the rising support that the Conservatives have secured over the same period of time?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it filters down to the average Canadian, right? I think that Jagmeet was in, I think it was Northern Ontario. He was in the last couple of years in a riding. He was doing a visit, and you know, people did come out and call him out for, you know, quote unquote propping up the Liberal government. I wonder if how many Canadians are aware of, you know, this agreement and, you know, them being in cahoots. I don't know. I think it works to Mr. Poilievre's favor, right? He says, you know, he can group the left together as one big blob and say, look, there's the guy, there's our opposition. These are the guys you should disagree with. These are enemies. We're here over on the right and we're up against the world. You know, as the official opposition, it's us versus everybody. We're the only ones standing in the way of another Trudeau government, or, you know, be it majority or minority with the NDP propping them up again. I this is a weird sort of thing, but I wonder why, like, you see this in other countries, you see actual coalitions. Canadians seem kind of allergic to them, but I wonder, you know, why wouldn't the NDP, you know, more fully integrate themselves in the Liberal government and call for ministerial roles? See that, you saw this in the UK years ago when David Cameron came in. I will say, having done that, and you wonder what happens with the NDP, what comes after this, I don't think the Liberal Democrats have recovered from forming a coalition government with the Conservatives in terms of their reputation. You know, once you dance with your political opponents, what becomes of your reputation after that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would just say, as my final observation for today's conversation, that I do think it has aided the Conservatives, because, as you say, Pierre Poilievre's ability to essentially align the Liberals and the Democrats in the minds of Canadians on different issues has freed him up to be the only alternative and find himself in majority territory on different public issues. Like, to be concrete about it, this week we could have talked about the controversy over the carbon tax, which we didn't do, but presently, whatever one thinks about carbon taxes, and we'll cover both the policy and the politics of it at the Hub next week, Pierre Poilievre finds himself as the only politician at the national level anyway, in, you know, something like 60% territory. He's in favor of getting rid of the carbon tax. And this week, the Liberals and the Democrats voted together in favor of not only maintaining it, but raising it come April 1st on the motion that we talked about in the first half. If you're opposed to abandoning the state of Israel in this extraordinary moment of need, there's only one party at the national level that reflects or is representative of that position. And you can kind of go down the line. I'm not making necessarily judgments about those particular policy areas. My point is that, as you say, the NDP and the Liberals have become effectively a blob on one side of those issues, and the Conservatives have effectively free terrain on the other side. And I can't help but think that that's contributed to Mr. Poilievre's success over the course of this agreement. But anyway, happy anniversary to the supply agreement. Well, for those of you who are real procedural nerds, you know, we'll leave it to you to have like a cupcake or a birthday cake or whatever you do. Harrison, I want to thank you for joining me today in lieu of Rudyard Griffiths, our executive director. He brought great insights and commentary as always. And finally, to Hub listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Hub Roundtable. We'll be back next Friday with the Hub's executive director, Rudyard Griffiths. Until then, take care and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the Join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Atter-Guzman. Thank you for listening.